Hello, I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop, and this is the Meet Cute Book Pod. Today, we have my chat with author C.M. Nascosta, an indie author who writes cozy monster romance. You may know her from her breakout hit, Morning Glory Milking Farm. She's smart and funny, and this conversation is a blast. C.M. talks about her introduction to genre romance, what she thinks was behind her first viral book, and what going viral felt like from her perspective. How she approaches indie publishing as a business, and how she works with her collaborators like artists and editors, her thoughts on having multiple pen names, her writing process and keeping track of the extended Cambric Creek universe, what's next for her, and maybe what the next big thing is in the world of fantasy romance. There's also a little aside about You've Got Mail and late-stage capitalism, and of course, she shares some books she's loved recently. Before we transition to that conversation, a little bit about CM. C.M. Nascosta is a USA Today bestselling author and professional procrastinator from Cleveland, Ohio. She's always preferred beasts to boys, the macabre to the milquetoast, the unknown darkness in the shadows to the Chad next door. She lives in a crumbling old Victorian with a scaredy cat dachshund, where she writes non-traditional romances featuring beastly boys with equal parts, heart, and heat, and is waiting for the Hallmark Channel to get with the program and start a paranormal lovers series. And now, through the magic of podcasting, here's my conversation with C.M. Nascosta. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to chat.
I'm super excited to be here.
Can we start by talking a little bit about what your background is with genre romance? Do you remember when you first picked up a romance?
So, it's really funny that you ask that because I feel like this conversation is being had a lot in online spaces in the past, just like in the past month or so. Like, I don't know, like all the Gen Xers are coming out of the woodwork and we're all talking about those books that we read at far too young an age all over social media. And I just tweeted this morning because someone posted something about Gen X coming in clutch, like with our Flowers in the Attic recommendations when we were like 8 years old. I'm like, yeah, exactly. That was totally it. Like, the Dahlengangers had me by the throat, and like My Sweet Audrina. I read Anne Rice's Beauty at far too young an age. B. Dalton was the scene of the crime at the mall. I was unsupervised. I had no idea what it was other than, oh, I like fairy tales. And so I feel like in the context of all these conversations we're having in online spaces, it always comes back to people, being so concerned with what kids are reading and what tweens are reading and the way YA books are marketed and the way more adult romance books are being marketed to look like YA. So it's blurring the lines between what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And some of us came from a generation where we had no oversight whatsoever. and we were reading, you know, hardcore BDSM in the middle of the mall at like 14 years old. My history with romance books is long and storied and varied. I don't think I really got hardcore into reading category romance, like consciously reading category romance, until it was probably like the early aughts, like 2001 to 2003. I used to take the train to work every day, and I signed up for Harlequins. They would like just send you a book automatically. You know, the olden days of, you know, you get your CDs and your books in the mail for directly from the publisher.
I mean, it's a book box, basically. We've just reinvented category romance with a book box.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. And the imprint I signed up for, I'm so sad it doesn't exist anymore because I would love to write for it today. It was Harlequin's Red Dress Inc. And it was, at the time, it was all considered like chick lit, and it kind of like skated the edge between category romance and women's fiction. And then every once in a while you would get like a Harlequin Desire or a Silhouette thrown in. And so that was, I think, the start of my conscious choice to start reading category romances when I was on the train to work every day.
And have you always also been a writer? Or are you one of those people that was like turning out books in second grade?
Yes. I've always been that person. But I've only started writing books for publication since the pandemic.
Oh, wow. Recent.
Yeah. Super recent. I published my first book in 2021, February of 2021. But I've always been a writer. I used to work for a lot of different blog, again, like early aughts, mid-aughts, like a lot of different blogs. I was I consider myself like sex work adjacent because I worked for a couple different adult sites that I like wrote for Eden Cafe. And I did copy for Babeland back when it was independently owned. So like I did a lot of trade shows and stuff like that, you know, the old days of Gawker Media. So like I've always been a writer, but I've never been an author until very recently.
And what was the thing that made you like sit down to write an actual novel?
I'd actually written a contemporary romance that was just like emotionally grueling and like almost killed me to finish it. And I took it to a writing day workshop, which they have all over the country all the time. So if you're out there and you're interested in pitching at a writing day workshop, just go on their website. And no, I don't work for them. I brought it to the workshop because like I found out like literally the last second that they were coming to Cleveland over the weekend. Like I found out on like a Thursday. And I was there on Saturday and I got feedback from an agent and from Donna McMeans, actually, who is a historical romance author. And Donna's advice was to go home, rewrite the first chapter and sell it to Harlequin immediately. And the agent I talked to wanted me to rewrite the first few chapters to change the POV and then send them the full. And then I never did. In classic CM form. And then I didn't. But I had it in the back of the mind. Like I had that, like an agent telling me, like, you need to just rewrite this from different, change the POV, send me the full, we want to read it. So I pivoted into monsters from there because I needed a break from emotionally grueling stuff. And I've always been a monster girl and monsters are fun. So I started my blog in like 2017, 2018. Started building my platform. I was just putting out short fiction with the aim of turning a lot of those stories either into full-length books or publishing them as short stories on Amazon. And then I didn't. in classic CM form. And then I didn't. And then the pandemic happened and I lost my job. And I'm like, well, I guess it's time to put one of these stories actually on Amazon. So we did. My first book was Girls Weekend, which started out on my blog originally. Published that February of 2021. And then Morning Glory Milking Farm was my second book that published August of that same year. And that's pretty much been my life since then.
I did not realize that was only your second published book. That must have been an extra wild ride.
Crazy, crazy. Going viral without a backlist is not something I would recommend to anyone who is courting virality. And it seems like everyone is these days. Like everyone wants to go viral on TikTok. Everyone wants to go viral on social media. If you don't have that backlist to support virality, it gets you nothing.
So for people who don't know, can you talk a little bit about your breakout book, Morning Glory Milking Farm?
So Morning Glory Milking Farm is technically a standalone. And I wrote it specifically to be, you know, a standalone that you didn't need any prior universe buy-in for. It takes place in the town of Cambrick Creek, which is the universe where all of my work, for the most part, takes place in. Morning Glory Milking Farm is about a very typical millennial named Violet. She is underemployed and overeducated and drowning in debt and student loans. And she, you know, is facing a future of potentially having to move back with her parents or just being destitute forever. She cannot find a job in her field because she is just too qualified for jobs in her field. And everyone is paying entry level and entry level does not pay her bills. So she finds this job listing as a milking technician in Cambrick Creek, this town she's never been to before. And she gets the job. And it turns out that the milking technicians at Morning Glory Milking Farm are responsible for collecting the milk from the clientele. And what Morning Glory Milking Farm is, it is a pharmaceutical offshoots. It was created by Big Pharma, because the pharmaceutical companies have figured out that they can synthesize a protein in Minotaur semen to make Viagra, like that world's version of Viagra. So of course they want all the Minotaur semen. So they've through extensive trial and error, they have found that, you know, if there is an aid in collection, they get a fuller, more plentiful collection from the clientele, which obviously higher yield at the milking farm means more little blue pills they can make. So
that's just science and capitalism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Violet is a human. She's never, you know, dated outside of her species before. Rourke is a Minotaur, obviously. He's one of her clients. And the book is really a very boring story. Like, their love story is actually like so paint by numbers, boring. There is no third act breakup. There is no big climax. There's no like crazy misunderstanding. There is a misunderstanding, but it's resolved literally within the same chapter. So yeah, I mean, it's like the most boring book you can possibly conceive, but he's a Minotaur, and that changes everything. Technically a workplace romance.
Okay, I will say it's not boring. I love this book with my whole heart. It's like shockingly cozy for like the description that was provided of the plot. Like, it's actually very sweet. But do you have any thoughts on why this book went viral? Was it timing? Was it subject matter? Was it magic?
So, I mean, I think it's probably a little of all three. I really blame the pandemic and the fact that we were all, you know, stuck inside with nothing but our own thoughts. And for like the rise, that like the absolute rise of monster and alien romance. Because just a few months before my book went viral, Ruby Dixon's amazing Ice Planet Barbarian series went viral on TikTok. And that series is already, you know, like 32 books deep. You know, she's been churning those books out for years, and people just caught on to them in 2021. And you can't convince me that that's not because of the pandemic. Like, we were all sitting home, we were all having a lot of weird thoughts, and we decided to act on them. I think timing of it was a big deal. I think the fact that it is a very boring, you know, boy meets girl story. It just happens to have this, you know, bonkers premise around it that makes it hooky. But because the love story itself is very, you know, straightforward boy meets girl, that the average reader was able to be invested in it, and that they didn't have, you know, like it's not like fantasy that you have to completely change your way of thinking. There's not this huge layered, you know, high fantasy world building that you have to buy into first. It's our world. It's a mirror of our world. It just happens to have different species living in it. So yeah, I think the world building is easy for those contemporary readers and histrom readers to get into without feeling like they need to, you know the middle name of every acorn in the Shire. I think the timing and the accessibility of it, and the fact that at that point, monster and alien romance wasn't what it is now. So it blew everyone's mind at the time. Now, if that same book were to come out today, I don't think it would be a blip on most people's radar, because, you know, we've since had 3 years of nothing but monsters and aliens taking over the blogosphere.
And what was the experience like of going viral? You talked a little bit about how it was hard because that was your second book and you didn't have a backlist. What did that feel like from your end?
Yeah, you know, it was fine. For me, it was fine. I got really good advice from Ruby Dixon, actually. Like, she messaged me shortly after the book took off, because it started, the viral domino effect started because of her. She shared it on her blog, her Facebook blog, and then Sarah McLean shared it on Twitter a few days later, and then it just kind of cascaded from there. It didn't hit TikTok for like probably a week, almost a full week since Ruby shared it the first time. So she told me, she's like, just get offline. Just don't go online for a couple of days. Like, just get offline. Don't read anything. And it's excellent advice. And that's advice I've already, that I write with. Like, I'm a big believer in not taking your external validation that seriously. Find your validation from yourself, from your characters, from your enjoyment of your book, and the story you're telling. Get your validation from friends and family. The second you start to need your validation from complete strangers, like, you've already lost the plot. Like, no validation will ever be enough when you need it from strangers. So that was easy for me because I've always written with that mentality anyway. But yeah, so just, I got offline. I didn't read anything for like a long time. I don't listen to podcasts. I don't listen to anything that my book is featured on. Like, I don't care. You are free to have whatever opinion you want. I don't need to hear it. So yeah, going viral for me was fine, but that's for me. And I already have 2 decades of corporate experience, which is hard. And before that, I had 4 years of opera conservatory and several years of opera theater. So this skin is like, I have a turtle carapace. Like, you cannot touch this shriveled black heart. There's nothing you can't be mean enough to get me. But I've seen so many authors since then who have gone viral, who have just been shredded, and they did not have that turtle carapace already. And it's hard. Like, everyone wants to go viral until you do. But it unleashes like the worst side of people. And even now, even to this day, and I actually had this conversation with a few peers this morning about, because Katie Robert posted something just today on I think Threads about how so many of us are perceived as brands and not people the instant we get popular. And when the general public views you as a brand, like, they don't give a shit. They will be as mean as they want because you're a brand to them. You're not a person anymore. I very deliberately set myself up as a brand from the onset. Like, my Monster Bait was a brand before I ever published my first book. So I am very fine letting my brand be the face of my business. And I keep myself to myself. Like, you don't get any of me. That's why when I send out logo and stuff, people will ask for author headshot and I send you my logo because that's my brand. You can have my brand, but you don't get me. So going viral for me was fine, but it's hard. Like cautionary tale. Like, it's a hard thing. And even to this day, like almost 3 years later, I still get tagged on like, what the fuck did I just read? Reviews every single week. So if you don't have a real thick skin, like, think hard about how viral you want to go.
I'm glad it wasn't terrible for you. A lot of romance authors new to traditional publishing are coming out of indie publishing or are coming out of fan fiction. Did you have anyone reach out to you about traditional publishing work?
I have over the years. When MGMF went viral, I was like besieged with offers. and at that point, I was not interested at all. I am still not hugely interested. I'm not going to say no to TradPub because I would like to do something with TradPub that is in no way connected to my existing series, but I wouldn't say no to doing something outside. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm writing it for TradPub, that's fine. I would be thrilled, but Cambric Creek is mine and I'm not interested in divesting myself of that.
Yeah. Keep your intellectual property.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very business brand. Like I said, I've got, you know, 20 plus years of retail corporate experience. So like playing empire is second nature to me. I have a really hard time letting go of things. And all I see is like big picture. So, and I tend to surround myself either with details oriented people or other big picture people. So like I just ordered special editions with sprayed edges and my shop manager saw it and he's pulling it out of the box. He's like, you paid someone for this? I'm like, yeah, I paid, because you tell me you're going to kill me in my sleep if I add any more to your plate. And he's like, no, order the clamps. We can do this. So it's like, I'm enabled by people like that who are like, no, we can bring this inside. We can do more. We can, you know, we can expand the business this way. So yeah, I have a really hard time of letting things go. So indie publishing for me, because I want control of my business and I want to build it into a business, is definitely the way to go for certain things.
I have been really fascinated watching the way that you are running like the CM Nascosta brand as a business. I think you're doing an incredible job. And I would love to know more about like how you are managing this and also managing to be an artist, like to be a writer. You like, where are you finding the time? How are you
delegating?
Yeah, it depends on the day of the week. And some people would probably tell you I don't manage it well, but it depends on the day of the week. And again, I don't expect anyone else to be able to do the things that I do. And I don't think any author should hold themselves to do what another author does. But I am coming to the table with retail experience, with corporate experience, like, you know, product launches. That was what I did. That was my day job for like a really long time. So like the logistics of the business piece of it. My biggest obstacle right now is space. Scalability and space, because I never think of things and how to scale them. Because in my corporate life, when I was handed a project, I was handed the project and the project was the project. I didn't have to worry about scaling it. Yeah, I didn't have to worry about scaling it because that was someone else's job to do. So now I like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I never think about scaling it. And then like in 2 months, like it's completely out of proportion and I've lost control. Wheels are off the bus. Jesus, take the wheel. So I have a shop manager. I have a PA. They save my bacon a lot of the time. but I mean, as far as how to balance, I consider Patreon my full-time job. Those readers have made an investment in me. So they are the ones I communicate with most frequently. They are the ones that get the sneak peeks and the art and all of the special little things. And when it comes down to, okay, am I going to spend the day writing or am I going to spend the day, you know, packing boxes for Patreon? Patreon is always going to win because those are my VIP readers. Amazon is secondary. And I know that's probably really backwards to a lot of authors out there. And actually, I know for a fact it is because I've had conversations with peers and they're like, no, Amazon is my top priority. Writing books for publication is all I want to do. And everything else is secondary. And that's totally fine. But I've always done everything kind of reverse engineered backwards. I mean, like my entire publishing career has been backward. Like I built my platform before I published my first book, rather than publishing a book and building a platform off of the book. I went into the first book already having a pretty substantial platform. So I've always done things kind of backwards and dumb, but it works for me. So yeah, it's a lot to manage, but space is my biggest issue right now. I'm looking into buying a second house. Everyone hates me in my house right now because there's like nowhere to turn around. Like the business has spilled into every single room of my house. And I have a huge house. So this is not like a little, you know, 2,000 square foot bungalow in the suburbs. I have this giant, almost 4,000 square foot crumbling Victorian. And every room of it is filled with boxes of books and art and stickers and there is nowhere to turn. So I'm in the process of buying a second house, like in the neighborhood to basically use as a closet, like to get all of this shit out of my house so that we have like some place to process, some place to store, some place to organize.
The space issue is very relatable.
Yeah.
Where do you find all of these artists and like, do you have an editor? Like, where are you finding people to collaborate with for your various projects?
Art for me is really tricky. I have very mild aphantasia, so I don't really visualize like anything very well. Like when I write a character, like they are a blob. They're an orc shaped blob in my head. It's a minotaur shaped blob in my head. And I don't speak art very well. So commissioning artists is actually like a huge pain point for me. When I find an artist that I do not need to like spoon feed information to, because if you're looking to me to spoon feed you the information to make this piece of art, you know, we are never going to work well together because I don't know what to tell you. I don't speak art. I cannot visualize it. So I can't tell you what to do. And if you need that from me, it's never going to happen. So when I find those artists that don't need that from me, like we will work together forever. So I use the same artists over and over again. My cover artist, the cover artist who does my painted clinch covers.
I love those.
He is so amazingly talented. And he just this month joined my team full time. Shinkatha is going to be doing all of our Cambric Creek covers going forward. Vic is Bloodrit. He does a lot of my character art that goes into the book boxes. And then NSFW Ami, she does all the stuff that Vic doesn't do. I will work with those handful of artists over and over again because they get it. Like, I give Vic just nonsense in his email and he's like, I got you. And he gives me back like perfection, like on the first sketch.
The covers you get are really excellent. I really do love them.
Yeah, I adore my covers. Like, I'm going to be real snotty and say I have the best monster covers on the market, and I don't care what anybody says. Shinkatha is wildly talented and I am so fortunate to have him on my team.
And I guess this has the side effect, the happy side effect of having your branding feel very consistent, right? If you have like a small group of artists who are doing a lot of your art.
Yeah, exactly.
So what would you say is your favorite part of indie publishing?
Oh my goodness. The control, because I am a little bit of a control freak. Like, writing is easy. Like, I know, like, there's a lot of folks out there that are like, oh, how do you write books? Writing is the easy part. Publishing is a fucking slog. Like, just the nonstop social media and constantly promoting yourself, constantly networking. Like, you cannot take your foot off the gas, especially in indie publishing. Although we are at the stage in trad pub where there's not a whole lot of money for the mid list. And if you sign up with a small publisher or an indie press, you're probably not going to get much, if anything, other than, you know, a handful of Instagram posts. We're seeing that play out with indie presses every single day on social media. So like, you have to be willing and able to promote yourself. You can't take your foot off the gas. So it's a slog. So it's a good thing that I'm very bossy and that I am a control freak, because otherwise that might break me, having to manage everything that I do. But I am fortunately very bossy and a control freak. So I like the control.
What would you say then is the biggest challenge of indie publishing for you?
The time, just finding the hours in the day. And that's like I always joke, I'm like, who has this kind of time? Like, people that will just complain about nonsense online and you read it and you're like, who has that kind of time? Like, how do you find the hours in the day to be mad at this? I would love to have that kind of spare time.
What advice would you have for somebody starting out in indie publishing now?
Don't skip the steps in working on your craft. And I think the biggest one for me, and this is like a personal annoyance for me, I think, don't buy into social authoring as a trade for knowledge. And I think that it's so easy. Like, we are right now like in this little bubble of publishing where it is so easy to just think that I got a lot of likes on this TikTok and I have 20,000 followers on this account, and oh, this reel really popped off, and think that that's success. Because like, I feel like when we start to fall into the trap of trading social media currency for actual tangible ROI, the goalposts have a way of moving. It's like when you start out, you're like, okay, I need to sell this book. Oh gosh, now I have 20,000 followers on TikTok, and oh my goodness, this one had 3 million views. Okay, well, are you selling this book? Or are you really excited about those? Do you know what I mean? We have a way of losing the thread, and we let, again, it's that external validation from social media and social authoring suddenly become more important than the actual book and long-term success within the industry. Everyone wants instant success. And I feel like we are in a place right now where it's easy to happen because so much is dictated by social media. You know, you can write a book that's super hooky with enough tropes that TikTok will jump on it and boom, it takes off. And oh my God, you're amazing. Oh my God, I'm a real author. You know, like, I'm a real girl. But then what happens after that book? Like, if you don't have any of the knowledge and skill to keep going, because this industry is a marathon, it's not a sprint. You know, then what? Then you're back to the drawing board. And if you go back to the drawing board on every single book, you're going to burn out real fast. So I think that's my biggest pet peeve with what I see out there, is just don't trade, you know, social authoring for what you actually want out of the industry. And it'll chew you up. Like, if you need all your validation from strangers, this industry will chew you up.
That seems like good advice. So speaking of branding and running a business. You introduced a new pen name a few months back, which was Olympia Ruse. What was the thinking behind like separating that from CM Nascosta? Like, what's your strategy?
So that book is on hold and I can't talk about it yet, but it's going to be coming back to me and then that book will be out and it'll be out in the world and it'll be fine. but my thought process behind separating it was honestly really simple. CM Nascosta is synonymous with cozy monster romance. I released a Krampus book back in 2021. There Arose Such a Clatter, Tales from the Naughty List. I love that book. It's super fun. But it is like dark erotica and people could not clutch their pearls hard enough. Like, I gave so many content warnings. I gave every content warning. And since then, whenever I talk about that book and people are like, well, what are the content warnings? All of them, literally all of them. You think of a content warning, it's probably in there. I gave everything at the front of that book and people were still like, oh, this is so much darker than anything she's ever written. I don't know if I can get, like, they could not clutch their pearls any harder. So that was a really good learn for me, that I've done such a good job branding Cambric Creek that I cannot get out from under it with this pen name. So anything I want to do that's darker is not going to be under CM Nascosta.
That makes sense. Yeah. It's always so interesting to me because sometimes that's the strategy. And I'm like, yeah, that totally makes sense because, you know, you don't want people to be confused. And then sometimes I'm like, I learn that an author I love has another pen name and I'm like, I wish they had told me sooner.
Yeah. Okay. So I've been very upfront about the Olympia Ruse pen name. I have another pen name that I've not talked about with anyone yet. I might later this year. Because I have a book coming out with this pen name later this year. I haven't decided yet. I haven't decided if I want it to be like completely secret or if I want to capitalize on my existing platform with it. I don't know. TBD. We'll have to like put a pin in that. I don't know. But I understand the appeal of both. Like, I totally get why certain authors will be like, this pen name, and then they'll put their actual name like in parentheses, because, you know, you've worked hard on your audience. Your audience expects you to share everything with them. So you don't want to hold back. But like I said, Krampus was a real good learn. So even if I were to put it under a different pen name and I make it explicitly clear what I'm writing, I would be worried that my readers are still going to be like, oh, if it's truly something, you know, off the wall. So I understand the appeal of both. I currently have, I have a book for pre-order on Amazon under a completely different pen name. It comes out later this year and we'll see if I divulge that. I'm not sure yet.
Interesting. I love a mystery. You know, one of my like eternal publishing mysteries, which like I don't want to solve it because I love that it's a mystery, but like Ruby Dixon has a TradPub pen name and I don't know what it is. No one knows what it is. And I just like to like walk through the bookstore and be like, maybe she's writing these cowboy books. Like, I don't know. It's fun.
That could be her. That could be it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I kind of play a game like that in my Discord server because I have like a patron Discord server. And I know there are a handful of authors in it. Some of them I know, and I know they're there. Some of them I have discovered completely on accident, and I have been low-key horrified when I did. Not that we ever say anything, not that like my readers say anything too terrible in there, but like I don't even know how I connected the dots, but like I figured out that like this pretty big author was in my server. I'm like, I was horrified. So like now my running joke is I assume everyone is Eloisa James. Because she was on the Corset and Crown podcast back, you know, in 2021. And Katie, the host, Katie and Sadie, they told her about my books and she's like, oh, I'm going to check out that Patreon. So now every single patron I communicate with, I'm like, you're Eloisa James. I know it. Like you're secretly Eloisa James.
Treat everyone as if they are Eloisa James.
Yes.
Eloisa, if you're listening.
Yes, Eloisa, if you're listening, we love you. We love having you.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about your writing process. I am watching indie authors publish so rapidly. And, you know, TradPub authors, I think particularly for genre romance, the pace is picking up for them. Like, publishers are requiring them to publish often more than one book a year, which used to be a lot. But you're publishing many books a year. Does the pressure interfere with the writing? Does it help? How does that work for you?
Okay. So I cannot write without a deadline. Like, my brain does not accept my lies. I cannot trick myself. I cannot do any of those little things that ADHD coaches will tell you to do to trick myself into working. My brain will not kick into gear until it sees the deadline on the horizon. And then everything else turns off and I become like a Muppet on a motorcycle with Tom Petty playing in the background. And all I do is work 24 hours a day until the book is done. And then it goes to my editor and then it comes back to me. And then I wind up like rewriting half of it because that's just what I always do. And like my beta readers and my alpha readers will be reading and they're like, oh, you changed this. I'm like, I will keep changing it until someone physically takes it from me and tells me I cannot change it anymore. I was a part of the Dangerous Tides Kickstarter last year with Jenny Nordback and Katie Roberts and Nisha Sharma. We had a blast, but you know, like deadline on a deadline and I turned in my book and then I got it back from the editor and I like rewrote like 60% of it. And they're like, what the fuck is this? This is a totally different book. I'm like, I'm sorry that I'm like this. But yeah, so my process, and then I feel like this is like another thing we've been talking about a lot in online spaces and like author spaces. I know authors, we either call ourselves plotters or pantsers. I'm a pantser to a degree.
Can you explain for those following along at home who are not in author spaces what the difference is between a plotter and a pantser?
Of course, I absolutely can. Okay, so a plotter is someone who writes to their outline, basically. They will plot the whole book. And I don't want to speak for plotters out there because I know someone is going to message me and say, that's not what we do at all. I'm not a plotter. But what I know of plotters, they plan the book. They plan out their book. They write an outline. They write to their outline. And there might be some deviation depending on the author, but for the most part, they start with a plan and they stick to their plan. Versus pantsers, we are doing everything by the seat of our pants. I am a pantser to a degree. I personally think there's a difference between plotting and planning. I think those are two different skill sets. I am not a plotter. I cannot write an outline. Outlines paralyze me. Planning is different. So like for me, you know, every book has a storyline and that storyline is usually what I'm just like, woo, whipping my pants off and we're swinging from the chandelier. That's where I'm pantsing things. You know, the individual book, because I'll start thinking, okay, I'm going to like, I have a, like a loose, like a, this needs to happen. This needs to happen. This is the ending. Okay. That's what we know going in. And then I let the characters direct like where we go from there. But I have this big meta story arc in the background of Cambrick Creek that has to be really tightly threaded from like book to book. So I have to constantly keep track of like what characters are where, who they know, who they've talked to, how they are interacting, and then like drop like the little breadcrumbs throughout each book to slowly move that bigger storyline forward. So there's a lot of planning involved in that, but I don't consider that plotting because every book is a mystery to me when I start it. I cannot work without a deadline. Like, I just posted today for my patrons, my schedule for the year, my publishing schedule for the year, because I put in all my pre-orders last year without knowing really what my travel schedule was going to look like. And I knew then, and I even said that, I'm like, this is probably going to shift. So just, you know, I'm putting in pre-order dates, but none of this is like real. I kind of have an idea of where things need to shake out now. So I've been like kind of laying out, you know, what book is going to fall where and how we're going to schedule things. And I really have to keep in mind like, okay, well, this book, I can't release this book before this book and this has to happen first. So I have to release this book. And I mean, I know there's all sorts of schools of thought on how you can become a plotter if you're a pantser. And I don't think it's behavior that needs to be corrected. I just think we all have our own creative processes. And when you try to change someone else's creative process, all you're doing is hampering their creativity and possibly paralyzing them the way an outline paralyzes me. So yeah, I start with just a general idea, and I definitely need a deadline.
Speaking of the ongoing plot in the background of all of your Cambert Creek books, you are creating a wiki, which is like an online database encyclopedia. How are you keeping track of this? Are you creating the wiki just because you have one anyway? Like, this is just lives on your computer. You might as well put on the internet.
Nothing lives in my computer. It's all up in my head. I started writing the wiki probably about 8 months ago. Just little entry by little entry. And that is helping me keep track of some of the more obscure things that I don't necessarily talk about in the books, but my characters, my patrons know very well. I've got this whole subworld of dead Hemmings that my patrons have all met, but the world hasn't yet. And a lot of what I do, I kind of do the same thing now that I used to do with my Tumblr blog. I will write a short, and in my head, I'm workshopping it for it to eventually either become a book or just those characters to enter the world somehow. So right now, I just released, I released a short last month, I think, called Shadows and Light. And it sort of features my werewolf subplot, those characters. I have two or three, let me see, filled vessel, codependent. I think there's two. There are two shorts from Patreon that I'm going to be releasing in the next couple months into the broad world, because I need those characters to enter the published world. Because we kind of have two halves. I've got Cambert Creek that the published world knows, and then I have the Cambert Creek that my patrons know, because I've been workshopping these characters for several years, and I'm slowly integrating them into the published works little by little. The wiki, unfortunately, has been a work in process for 2 years. It's never going to get done until I have a substantial break. I've got no books coming up, and this is all I'm going to work on, kind of thing, which I actually think is going to happen at the end of by Halloween. By Halloween, I'm not going to have anything on the horizon, because at that point, the Girls Weekend series will have completely wrapped up, and the big meta plot line we've been building in Cambert Creek will have also wrapped up. So at that point, it's going to be a hard series reset, and I'm going to take a bit of a break, and we're going to get the wiki up. So you can figure out who the hell all these people are, who all these dead Hemmings are. And then the first book after the break is probably going to be The Watchers, which is my haunted house book that I have been talking about for 3 years. It is all I want to write, but I just don't have time for it. And yeah, so we'll do a hard series reset from there.
Lots to look forward to.
Tons.
I am so overwhelmed that you have not only this very complicated world in your head, but that you have to have two versions of it, because there's the one that's public and then there's the Patreon one.
I know. It's intense. But I've really been sliding a lot of those characters into the main narrative. I think you've either seen or you've met most of the big players. I'm in the process of finishing the last little bit of Hexanoct, which is the next book that's coming out. It is the second book of Wheel of the Year. It's a return to Ladybug and Anzan, who is my witch character and her big, beefy spider boyfriend. The character that is making his way into that book, readers met back in Two for Tea the first time. So it's just slowly threading all of these characters back into the larger narrative. But yeah, it's a lot.
But very fun for readers, I think. One of the joys of romance.
I hope so. It's fun for me, and that's mostly what I care about. That's fun for me. Like, some of my books are just like one long extended joke for my own amusement. And if someone else finds it funny too, well, then I've done my job.
I mean, I really think one of the joys of genre romance in its sort of traditional structure is that often you would get, particularly it started in historicals, right, where you'd have like a family and like every sibling must have a book, or, you know, Bridgerton, that structure.
Yeah.
And I think you have that in Cambert Creek in the sense that like it's not one big family, but like a side character from this book then gets a book.
Yeah.
And you start to feel like you know the world and you're like seeing old friends, which is, I think, like a very warm feeling for readers.
I hope so. I mean, that's definitely how I want it to see, or how I want it to feel. And you know, those readers that met me initially through Morning Glory Milking Farm, if you go back and you read Girls Weekend, which actually came out first, like Kosh and Luriel feel like, oh, them, like we know them. So yeah, like I want my readers to go from book to book and like recognize the people, recognize the characters, you know, recognize the little throat. Like there's a little lizard boy, like amphibian. He's not even a lizard. He's like an amphibian boy. And he's in Morning Glory Milking Farm. He's in Sweet Berries. He's in a couple of the shorts. Like he licks everything. That's his thing. He's just, Finny is going to lick something. And, you know, he doesn't have a role in the, he's a little kid. He doesn't have like a big, you know, role to play in the story, but he's just that fucking kid who licks everything in the background. And like, we all know that kid. Like, we would be like, and that's my main goal, is I want you to recognize every character in Cambert Creek as someone you know. Like someone you've met, that bitch from your church, or that really annoying mom from PTA, or like just, you know, the cashier that you always chat with at the grocery store. I want you to recognize every character. So I really, even though, you know, they are orcs and minotaurs and, you know, various species and ogres and trolls and everything else, I really work hard to keep their characters grounded and recognizable, because I want you to feel like this is a real place. Because it feels like a real place, you're invested in what happens next.
You mentioned sending your book off to your editor, getting edits back. I'm always curious, in the indie world, right? You're finding your own editor. In the traditional published world, your editor bought your book, right? And they chose it and they're working with you.
Yeah.
How did you find your editor? Do you always work with the same one? Did it take a while to get into a groove? Like, how did that work for you?
So it took a while for me to find the right editor. the first, actually two people, my very first editor was just, I was back when I was a baby and I didn't know, you know, my head from a hole in the ground. And it was just someone I found on Facebook, and they were, I'm pretty sure they edited errors into my book that weren't there when I handed it off. The second editor is someone I've known from a previous life in a writing context, and it just didn't work out. The editor I have now, she's fantastic. She's actually one of my patrons. You know, she's one of my readers. She was already one of my readers. So it was really serendipitous that she actually does this, you know, for a living on the side. So that was great. And then my alpha reader is someone who has read every single romance book under the sun. If you name it, she has read it. So she is a wonderful resource, because she can tell me like, this is great. Oh my God, I'm hooked by this. I love this character. I laughed out loud when this happened. And if the wording is clunky, she's not going to pull punches. She's going to let me know. So yeah, I'm fortunate that I feel like I'm finally at a place where I've built a really good, stable team. But yeah, it's definitely a trial and error getting there when you're indie, because you don't have that, you know, you don't have that built-in pub team from the, you know, hit the ground running with. So yeah, it's a chance. I think that's probably a big challenge for a lot of people out there, you know, finding your artist, finding your editor, finding your cover designer, finding all those little things that you have to do as the publisher.
Yeah. It feels a little bit like if you move to a new city and then suddenly all of the things that you, like all of your services, you have to find new, you have to find a new like gym, you have to find new doctor, you have to find, you know.
Yeah.
And eventually you'll find them. But for a while,
yeah,
just kind of
Yeah, you go to that weird gym next to the Walgreens, and it's kind of sketchy, and then you're like, oh, phew, I found a good one. Yeah, absolutely.
What would you say is your favorite trope to write? Do you have one? Is it also your favorite trope to read?
Oh, I don't have a favorite trope, to be honest.
What's your favorite, like, monster?
I don't have a favorite monster either. I have favorite character archetypes.
Okay.
Like, a morally gray, competent asshole is my kryptonite. I love that character. And like, people have always asked me, like, who are your favorite characters, like, in your world? It's Grayson, Tate, and Jack, like, those three characters. And they share a common core. Like, they share that hyper competent fucking asshole gene. And I love them. I love character archetypes, because you can do anything with that. Like, it doesn't make a difference what the trope is if I have that character that I love. So like a character like Tate, or a character like Luriel from Girls Weekend. Like, I love that strong woman that's still emotionally vulnerable, but is willing to put her vulnerability aside to get shit done. Like, I can eat that with a spoon. I love that. So yeah, I don't necessarily have favorite monsters. I don't necessarily have favorite tropes. I have favorite character cores. And then once I have that core, I can do anything with them.
That makes sense. So it's sort of the opposite of, like, I love friends to lovers. What happens if I drop this person into it? It's, I love this character archetype. What happens if I drop them into a friends to lovers?
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there anything that you have been thinking about writing, but you haven't figured it out yet, or you're scared to try it and you're just kind of letting it sit?
I don't think I can say that right now, because my brain is too wrapped up in closing out these big character arcs right now. Like, I don't have room for anything else. I'm closing out Girls Weekend. I'm closing out Wheel of the Year. Closing out those two series is going to close out the big Cambert Creek arc. So I'm excited to see what we come up with next. I am personally, outside of CM Nescosta, I am going to start getting out of monster romance, towing my way out of monster romance a bit. Kind of want to get back to humans just ever so slightly. And I can't promise, like, human-y humans. Like, it still might be like PNR humans. but, you know, monster romance is a wild emerging genre. You know, obviously it has existed for years. I'm certainly not the first monster romance author. But like, my book going viral, Ruby Dixon's Aliens book going viral, like, that whole thing, like, that whole crazy tornado, it really opened the door, and this genre has just taken off in insane ways. So the readership is still so hungry for books, but I almost feel as if the playing field, it feels slightly different to me. And again, this is probably because of my corporate background. I am very used to being at the front edge of something. I don't like being in the middle. So, like, I love monster romance. I love Cambert Creek. I'm never going to stop writing Cambert Creek. But that part of my brain is already like, okay, we have to get out of this. What's next? You know, like, where do we go next? What do we move into next? So, because I make trends, I don't follow them. So, like, how are we going to take all of these weird ideas we have and move them into the next genre that doesn't have that existing?
I think paranormal romance is back. It's the front end of it is coming, you know, it's like really big in the early 2000s, you know, it comes up. It's not gone, but it's not currently the trend. I think it's coming. I think it's back. Like, it's on its way.
I think I agree. And like, and again, a conversation we've been having a lot in like author spaces and places online, like, what's going to be the next big thing? in fantasy romance and paranormal romance and monster romance? What is the next thing? And I, like, my patrons all know this, and I've been talking about it on my social media a little bit. I cannot explain it. Moonblooded Breeding Clinic is the third book in the Cambric Creek, you know, main series, main title series. It is, I mean, it's by far not my most popular book at all, like even remotely, but it's my number two best-selling title for like months now. And I cannot explain it because those readers are not coming from book two in the series. They're not coming from the other, you know, the other Hemming brother book. I don't know why they are landing on this all on its own. It's like, are werewolves back? Like, are werewolves a thing again? Because they just, to me, they feel evergreen. Like, it just feels like an evergreen thing that never goes away. And because it never goes away, it's never on top because it's just always there. But I don't know, like, with Allie's book coming out, and like, I feel like we're on the cusp of like PNR really being its own like gorgeous, dirty thing again. And that's exciting. Like, I'm super excited for that.
PNR, paranormal romance, for those.
Yeah.
I think with Bride by Allie Hazelwood and The Fake Mate by Lana Ferguson, which was like a paranormal rom-com sort of thing, I think if TradPub has it, then it's definitely kind of like, it's been bubbling up for a while already, you know. Yeah. If it made it.
And like, I know there's been a lot of discourse about Allie's book like in the past week, but I'm going to repeat something I said on another blogger's on a book blogger's Instagram page. Like, it doesn't have to be Omegaverse. It doesn't have to be, you know, the best PNR book you've ever read. You don't have to compare it to every other single PNR book on your shelf. It doesn't have to be monster romance. It doesn't have to be anything but the book it is, the book she wrote. What that's going to do for the rest of us, like, it's a mainstream New York Times bestseller kicking down the fucking door with knots. Like, do you know how big that is? Do you know the ramifications of that are huge? You know, it's not Omegaverse, but it's bringing the possibility of Omegaverse to the forefront. That and The Fake Mate is bringing the possibility of Omegaverse to the forefront. And I don't write Omegaverse, but I have friends that do. That should be wildly exciting. And like I said before, not everyone has TradPub aspirations. I don't think you have to, but it's opening the door to a much wider readership. Like I said, if MGMF were to come out today, I don't think it would be a blip on most people's radar because the field is saturated with really good monster romance right now. Back when it came out, it was mind-blowing for people. So the fact that we are now having these big authors come out with books that are kind of dabbling in our end of the pool, that's super exciting because that's going to open the door for that whole new readership to have their minds blown.
Right. I think it'll bring people in, people who read every other Allie Hazelwood book and maybe did not think they were like a werewolf person.
Right.
Are probably going to pick up Bride, and then they're probably not going to stop after Bride. Right. But Allie's backlist doesn't have werewolves, so they're going to find them somewhere else.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's super exciting.
Yeah, I'm into it. I'm ready for it. The other one I want, and I think I'm just speaking this into existence, I don't know if it's really coming, but I think it's time for romantic suspense to come back, but be like less ex-military heavy, and more like not that. But there's like a couple rom-coms that have come out, like rom-commy branded books that are actually like spy books. And I feel like with the dark romance energy.
Yes.
Which is like romantic suspense is dark romance, except that like, the hero is more of a traditional hero, right. Or the heroine is more of a traditional. No one's like being kidnapped by their love interest.
No, no one's having limbs amputated. No one is having, you know, no one is having things stuck in random orifices.
Right. But it's like the energy of it.
I would love that. I would love to have. Yeah. Yeah. Like marry a rom-com with like the ethos of a dark romance without the darkness. Super fun. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I want people's lives in danger, and then I want them not to die.
Yeah, exactly. I keep joking, like, all I want to write is like Cambric Creek mysteries, like cozy, high heat paranormal mysteries.
I am so sold on that idea. If you ever want to write something just for me personally, like, that sounds great.
I know, right? I know. Because, like, you think, like, oh, cozy mysteries. Oh, you can't have high heat in that. Well, why not? Why can't you?
That's all I want. That's all I want.
Yes.
That sounds so perfect. Please write that.
Yeah. So back to the previous question of like where my head is. That's where my head has been like for the last year. I keep thinking like Camber Creek mysteries. That's what I need to be doing.
Okay. Well, if you find the time in your busy schedule, once you have like closed everything else up, I will be delighted when that appears on my screen. So before I let you go, a couple wrap up questions. For people who haven't read any of your books, but they have listened to this podcast and they're like, that sounds like great fun. Where would you recommend that they start?
So, okay, that's a loaded question. My personal, as the author, preferred reading order is my publication order. If you are brand new to monster romance, a two half question. If you are someone who has read monster romance, alien romance, PNR, but you are new to me, read them in publication order. If you are new to monster romance, start with Morning Glory Milking Farm. That would be my advice.
All right. For what it's worth, I started with Morning Glory Milking Farm and it worked for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It that's the gateway. And I wrote that book very intentionally. Violet is brand new to this world. So I'm assuming that you are just as dumb as Violet. You are the dumb human reading through Violet's dumb human eyes, and it is new to you as well. So you are discovering the world along with her, versus every other book in the series is through the eyes of a human who has already lived amongst these monsters for a chunk of time. But MGMF is very specifically the entry point if you are new to the world. Girls Weekend technically happens before in the chronology, Girls Weekend happens first, but you can make your way back to Girls Weekend once you've read MGMF.
Yeah. There's not like major spoiler issues or anything like
that. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
If you can even keep track, what is your next release coming out that people can look forward to?
My next release. So go to my link tree. It will have all my pre-orders listed on it. My next release is Hexanoct. It is the second book of the Wheel of the Year little sub-series. They are super short novellas. They are very fast and easy reads. So Hexanoct comes out. We're pushing that one up to the beginning of May or the beginning of April. And then my next big release, like big, huge honkin' release is He Loves Me Not. I just did the cover reveal for it this past week. It is absolutely stunning. Like when you see this book cover, you will audibly gasp. It is You've Got Mail in the Discord age with rival flower shops, a half human and a Naga. So he's like a snake man. I'm so excited for this book. Like I can already tell this is going to be my favorite book of the year. It's like it's enemies to lovers. And I know like You've Got Mail is such a divisive movie. Oh, we should have talked about this earlier and I could have asked your opinion. What do you think of You've Got Mail? Is that one of those romance movies that like rom-coms that you hate because it's sad and she loses her shop, or do you find it to be an enduring romance?
So I haven't watched it since I opened the bookstore, but
oh my goodness.
Here's the thing about You've Got Mail. It's a retelling of a retelling of a retelling.
It's a retelling of The Shop Around the Corner. Yeah.
Yeah. And The Shop Around the Corner was a retelling of a play that was about a perfume shop. And the play is a delight. I have seen it. So I love the basic sort of like core structure of that story, I think really endures. Whether You've Got Mail specifically endures for me, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I feel like You've Got Mail, it happened at a very specific time in the book culture. And like what I find really interesting about all of a sudden we're being told, like indie authors especially, we're being told that like Barnes & Noble is our savior because, you know, the new CEO of Barnes & Noble has really empowered a lot of the booksellers, you know, in the stores to curate the collection, and shelf space isn't automatically going to, you know, the big five publishers who pay for the space. You know, the booksellers have the option of curating that book talk table and that monster romance end cap. And so we're definitely seeing a lot more of our books in brick and mortar stores where we never had that opportunity previously. So we're being told like Barnes and Noble is the savior of indie publishing and Amazon is, you know, the big mean giant evil overlord. But some of us are old enough to remember when Barnes and Noble put all of those little mom and pop stores out of business. And for those of you who have not seen the seminal classic, the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan classic, You've Got Mail, like that's basically the crux of it. Like it is the big Barnes and Noble mega bookstore that puts the shop around the corner out of business. So it's very surreal to be an indie author in a space being told Barnes and Noble is your answer when Barnes and Noble is what kind of ruined the book industry from the start. You know, like they put all the shops out of business. Like there was nothing left. Like Borders gone. All your little mom and pop brick and mortar indie stores gone. All that was left was Barnes and Noble. And then Barnes and Noble didn't carry anyone's books other than, you know, like Tom Clancy and Colleen Hoover. So we're starting to see that change. And I'm so excited that we are starting to see indie bookstores popping up again. And it's so wonderful to see how successful you are on social media and seeing authors come visit. And it's just, it's wildly exciting seeing indie bookstores having their day again. But some of us remember when you got put out of business in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such an interesting market, right? Particularly for indie authors, many of whom have to rely on Kindle Unlimited for people to find their work. Like, I would never tell an indie author that they shouldn't be on KU because, right, like, Amazon is bad. But Amazon is bad. And Amazon is also bad for indie authors, but you need it.
Yeah.
Right? The way that we set it up.
Totally.
So it's such a, you know, and like, when we get people, the one thing that I truly, truly cannot stand is when people come in and they're like, this book is cheaper on Amazon. And I'm like, there's a reason for that.
Right.
And the reason is that they are selling it at a loss.
Yeah.
And major publishers will sell it to them at cheaper than they'll sell it to us.
Exactly.
And when everybody goes and buys their books on Amazon and we're not here anymore, they aren't going to be cheaper on Amazon. Like, that's not going to keep happening.
Exactly. Like it's all by design. Like, welcome to late stage capitalism. This is all by design.
Yeah.
So like we advertise, like my shop advertises to indie booksellers because I feel like our hands are tied no matter where you turn in the industry, because booksellers buy from Ingram Spark, and Ingram Spark is sometimes the biggest, you know, the biggest baddie in the room, but no one knows about them other than publishing insiders. So the general reading public doesn't know that Ingram Spark is actually the one holding everyone by the balls. So it's like we've set up direct chain channels with probably half a dozen stores at this point, where, you know, you just send a message to my shop manager. He packages it up. You get a PayPal invoice and you get the books directly from us at the full 45% that we offer on the Ingram Spark catalog. So if you're an indie bookseller listening, all you have to do is shoot an email to press@cmnescosta.com or shoot me a message on Instagram and we will get you connected with Eric and he will get that set up for you. But like, it's wild. It's wild to me, like this crazy conflux of where we are, because all we have are enemies around us, but we need them. Like, we can't exist without them. We can't have our books in bookstores without Ingram Spark. So many indie authors can't have careers without Amazon. So we need them. It sucks.
Yeah. It's a really interesting time in publishing. It probably always is. I just wasn't at the previous interesting times in publishing and right. I'm here at this one. But
I feel like TradPub is also at a weird conflux of, you know, like you mentioned earlier, all of a sudden the big trend in TradPub is to scoop up existing indie authors who have best-selling titles because, you know, you can't compete with us. You know, we can do this without you. So now they want the indies, you know, they want us. So yeah, it's a crazy time to be alive.
It sure is. And everyone is doing their best.
Right. Limping along.
All right. Before I let you go, could you recommend a book or two that you have read and loved recently?
I'm going to recommend Allie's Bride. I think it's a super fun PNR and it feels like a good classic PNR. I read it in an afternoon and I loved it. And then the other book I'm going to recommend is also a werewolf book, actually. Werewolves are really having their day. I'm so excited. This is by an indie author. It is a debut book, A Wolf in My Garden by Allegra Hall. The female protagonist, she is half Maori. So it really features heavily the language and the culture. It's fantastic representation. It's an own voice representation. So it's really nice to see, especially in a really, you know, unserved population. So yeah, I think those would be my two recs this week. Both wolves.
Thank you so much. This has been really so fun.
This has been a blast. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
And there you have it. A huge thank you to Siam Nascosta for sharing her wisdom and being a general delight. If this conversation has made you want to pick up a copy of one of her books, you can do that in our shop or on our website, meetcutebookshop.com. And you can follow her on her Instagram at Siam Nascosta or on her website, siamnascosta.com. And that's good branding. If you've been enjoying this podcast, I would so appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review it on the podcast listening platform of your choosing. That helps other people find us, and that helps us keep making podcasts. That's all for this episode of the Meet Cute Book Pod. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop in San Diego, California, and I hope you'll tune back in for more deep dives into romance writing, reading, and publishing.